Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does the soul of Cuba lie with its 11 million current residents or with the millions in exile who could not stand their beloved homeland under the Castro regime? The family, famous the world over for producing Bacardi rum, has a history as long and complicated as that of Cuba itself, starting with the migration of Patriarch Facundo Bacardi from Spain when Cuba was still a tightly controlled Spanish colony. While building a liquor empire that even today remains almost entirely in family control, the Bacardis also fought valiantly for Cuban independence, pioneered remarkably modern standards of employee benefits and brand management, and later rebuilt their empire in exile after a once cordial relationship with Fidel Castro quickly turned sour. The story of the family and its much-loved and much-changed homeland is the subject of a book by NPR correspondent Tom Gelton. It's just been released in paperback, and it is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Tom, welcome to Think.
Chris, it's terrific to be with you.
How did Facundo Bacardi find his way into the rum business? This was not his family legacy in Spain.
No, it's not. In fact, when he got started in the rum business in Cuba in 1862, Cuba was not even known for its rum. Most of the rum at that time was produced in the Caribbean countries, but Cuba was famous, well-known for sugar production. It was the biggest sugar producer in the world. At that time, molasses, which is a byproduct of producing sugar, the price of molasses was very low on the international market. And so the conditions were perfect for the creation of a new Cuban rum industry, because rum, of course, can be made from molasses by distilling molasses. Facundo Bacardi, among various other Cuban businessmen, recognized that it was a perfect time to establish a rum business in Cuba. He was the only one, however, who was able to do it successfully. And the reason for his success is that he developed a new technique for making rum, through improved filtration techniques, aging techniques, different kind of yeast. He was able to produce a light rum, almost clear, transparent, a white rum, that was much easier to drink than the dark, heavy spirit that had preceded it. In particular, this allowed rum to be mixed with other beverages, fruit juices and sodas and so forth, and, you know, eventually the introduction of this new style rum gave rise to the whole age of cocktails. So that briefly, Chris, is the history of how Facundo Bacardi became such a success in the rum world. He just started out, like many businessmen do, looking for a way to make money.
And there was a lot of trial and error getting rum from the sort of stuff that pirates drank to this new style.
There was. It took many years. It took a lot of experimentation, you know, and not only that, Facundo Bacardi's rum company, the Bacardi Rum Company, went bankrupt. I've lost track of how many times it went bankrupt. It went bankrupt over and over and over again. And, you know, in sort of business histories, we're used to thinking of persevering entrepreneurs as finally being rewarded for their perseverance. But in Facundo Bacardi's case, he never would have stayed in business had he not married a very wealthy woman who kept turning over parts of her inheritance to him. So, you know, this is sort of the realistic way that some businesses get established. I mean, in the end, you know, even though he was a foresighted businessman, it took a lot of money from his wife in order for him to get through that difficult period.
He did, from the beginning, have a sort of uncommon knack for branding things. He would sign the bottles.
You're right, Chris, and this is very important. In those days, rum was a commodity, which means that a rum product was not differentiated according to its manufacturer or place of manufacture. It was often just sold in barrels the same way sugar or grains or something else would be sold. There was no idea of a particular brand. But he was really, he thought that his rum was different, which it was, and better than other rums. And so he decided that he would try to distinguish his brand. And you're right, he personally signed every bottle, pasted a label on the bottle and personally signed it. The other thing he did, Chris, is that he put a symbol, the symbol of a bat, on the bottle. At that time in Cuba, a lot of people were illiterate. They wouldn't recognize necessarily a signature on a bottle. So to reach, to sort of broaden the brand image, he put a graphic symbol of a bat on the bottle as well as the signature.
And what was the reason for the bat? Because that would seem like an odd choice, but it had a particular symbolism at that time in Cuba.
It did. I mean, you know, today we would think of it as a pretty creepy thing to put on a bottle of something that you wanted to reach a broad market. But in those days, both in Spain, where Facundo Bacardi originally came from, and in eastern Cuba among the native population, in both those areas, the bat was actually seen as a symbol of fortune and good luck. You know, Chris, I found a letter from one of the early Bacardis explaining to somebody why they had chosen this bat as their symbol, and I thought it was really clever. This person wrote, as creatures, bats exemplify the ideal of brotherhood because they live and fly together. They symbolize self-confidence because they can fly in the dark without hitting anything. They stand for discretion because they keep silent, and they represent faithfulness because they always returned home. So this was, at the time, considered a very positive symbol and an appropriate one to put on a bottle.
So during these years, when Facundo Bacardi is trying to get his company off the ground with sometimes a great deal of success and sometimes less, Cubans were starting for the first time to really resent the Spanish rule that at first they had accepted. Can you talk first about what kept the island initially sort of loyal to Spain?
Some Cubans of that era might dispute your suggestion that they were content with Spanish rule, but I think that there are a couple of factors that explain why Cuba had this reputation. You're absolutely right. It was known as it was siempre fiel, always faithful. You know, years and years after other Latin American countries fought and won their independence from Spain, Cuba had not yet achieved it. But there are a couple of reasons for it. One is the simple fact that Cuba is an island. Two, it was the wealthiest by far of all of Spain's colonies, and Spain was much more determined to hold on to Cuba than it was to hold on to its other colonies. And being an island, they were able to put enough troops on the island and police and so forth, informants and an intelligence network. They were able to hold on to Cuba more than they had been able to hold on to the other islands. And the other thing is actually kind of a racial explanation. Because Cuba was a sugar colony, it employed a vast, vast numbers of slaves. And the white Cubans, the Spanish Cubans, particularly the plantation owners and those who were allied with them, were very nervous about the prospect of that big black majority at some point gaining its independence. And so they were afraid what that might mean politically for them on the island. So they looked to Spain. Those white Cubans tended to look to Spain as their protector vis-a-vis the black population. So there were a number of unique factors that sort of explained why Cuba remained in Spain's orbit. Nevertheless, from the early years of the 19th century, there was always a very vigorous independence movement in Cuba. And the Bacardis, were associated with that from an early point.
Yeah, in fact, Bacardi's son Emilio, who would later take over the reins of the company, twice was jailed fighting for independence from Spain.
Yeah, Emilio was the, we were talking earlier about Facundo Bacardi, the Spanish immigrant who started the company. He remained loyal to Spain pretty much throughout his life, but his oldest son, Emilio, who was incidentally the first Bacardi born in Cuba, like many young Cuban men of his generation, became deeply involved in the fight for independence. He never himself took up weapons. He never actually went off in the mountains and joined the Cuban Liberation Army that was fighting against Spain. But he played an important role by raising funds for the rebels, by acting as an intermediary between them and their supporters in the cities and even outside Cuba. He was a conspirator. He wrote a lot of underground propaganda on behalf of the independence movement. And you're right, he was arrested. There were two wars for independence in Cuba. The first one began in 1868 and lasted until 1879. And the second one began in 1895 and lasted until 1898. And in each of these wars, towards the end, Emilio Bacardi was arrested as a result of his conspiratorial activities. sent to Spain and imprisoned in Spain. So he really did a lot for this independence cause. And in the Second War, he and his wife actually sent their 17-year-old son off to fight with the rebels.
And one major difference in the outcome of those two different battles for independence was that the second time around, as opposed to the first, the United States recognized the right of Cuba to be an independent nation.
Well, yeah, sort of.
Get complicated later.
It gets complicated. In fact, here's the Cuban analysis of that second war. It began in 1895. Now, this is the war that you and I and the rest of us learned to call the War of 1898, the Spanish-American War of 1898. In fact, it was the Cuban War for Independence, and it began not in 1898, but in 1895. And the Cubans say that by the summer of 1898, they were on the verge of victory. They, after years and years of very bloody fighting, they had almost defeated the Spanish army in Cuba and were on the verge of getting their independence. And there were those in the United States who actually regarded this as not necessarily good news. They weren't actually sure that Cuba should be independent. Now, the U.S. Congress at the time and several politicians were on record as supporting Cuba's independence. But when it came right down to it, there was some nervousness about this, not in part because of Cuba's large black population, and there was a fear that this could be a destabilizing element politically in that Caribbean region for U.S. southern interests in particular. And so the United States does, in fact, join the war on the side of the Cuban army and deliver the final crushing blow to Spain that defeats Spain and takes Cuba away from Spain. But rather than immediately recognize Cuba's independence, the United States occupies Cuba for the next 4 years. And when the United States does finally leave Cuba, it does so only on the condition that the Cubans put a provision in their constitution that the United States could return and reoccupy Cuba anytime the United States felt that was necessary to protect its security interests. So it was a very conditional independence that Cuba won at that time.
And at this point, Emilio Bacardi was mayor of his hometown in southern Cuba, which is Santiago. Is that right?
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
How did he cope with the American occupation?
Well, you know, the beauty of the Bacardi story, Chris, and the reason that I selected it to sort of bring this larger Cuban story to life is that at every sort of important turning point in Cuban history, going back 150 years, there's always some little Bacardi angle. I mean, you can explain what's going on in Cuba through the lives and adventures and experiences of the Bacardis, who somehow seem to be involved at every phase. Emilio, having been a patriot, a revolutionary, a very esteemed leader in his hometown of Santiago, as I said before, he was in prison. He is released at the end of the war. He comes back to Santiago, and he finds the U.S. flag flying over the city hall in Santiago. He, like many Cubans, is distressed by the way the Americans have sort of taken over the city and are occupying it and basically blocking the development of any kind of Cuban institutions. He becomes an advocate for Cuban interests in negotiating with the U.S. authorities. And after a few months, the residents of Santiago go to the U.S. military governor, General Leonard Wood, and say, "We think we should have a Cuban as our mayor." Up until that point, a U.S. Army major was acting as the mayor of Santiago. They say, "We want a Cuban for our mayor. And General Wood says, "Who would you like to have?" And they say, "We want Emilio Bacardi to be our mayor." So he is made the first mayor of Santiago under U.S. military occupation. And then there is a very interesting relationship between him and General Wood as they sort of tussle over Cuba's political future.
NPR correspondent Tom Gelton is my guest. His book is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. We'll be back in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is NPR correspondent Tom Gelton, whose book, just released in paperback, is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Another remarkable thing about the Bacardis, Tom, was their early understanding of the importance of diversification and making sure that they had multiple markets. Can you talk about how that started to take shape in the early part of the 20th century?
Yeah, these are really good questions, Chris. As with the what you earlier mentioned about their recognizing the importance of branding, which really marked them as a, in those days, a very progressive company and forward-thinking company, it's the same with diversification. Emilio Bacardi took over the company after the death of his father, and after Emilio's death in 1922, his sister's husband, his brother-in-law by the name of Enrique Schwegg, took over. Enrique Schwegg was a French-Cuban, and he, to a much greater extent than others in the family, believed that it was important for Bacardi to extend its marketing outside Cuba. And he really put a lot of emphasis on developing an export market. He used to sell, samples of Bacardi rum to every international trade fair anywhere in the world that he could get them to, in an effort to really advertise, promote Bacardi rum around the world. So he believed, first of all, in diversifying the market geographically. Second, he believed that it made sense, at least by the late 1920s, for Bacardi to start thinking about moving outside rum. And he convinced his business partners in the family to invest in a defunct brewery in Santiago in 1927, and Bacardi got into the beer business, invested a lot of money in the beer business. It was considered to be a very controversial move at the time because it was very expensive, and everyone at that point associated Bacardi exclusively with rum. They started making a new beer in Cuba. It was called Hatue beer, named for an Indian chief who had resisted Spanish rule back in the 1500s. But as it turned out, Hatue beer was a huge success. And by, over the next 30 years, it became very popular beer in Cuba and made a lot of money for the company. And these two sort of ideas, or three ideas, if you count the importance of branding, really are the principles that explain Bacardi's ultimate commercial success. The diversification internationally, the expansion, moving into international markets, moving into other products besides just rum, and the very great emphasis on promoting a brand.
They opened a distillery in Mexico in the 1930s, I guess, or in the late 20s and 30s. And that was not something they initially really wanted to do. Can you talk about what that was? And it turns out to have been a very key move.
Well, this was in the period of Prohibition. And, Americans were suddenly prohibited from buying alcohol, at least legally, openly. And, of course, there are a lot of drinkers in America in the 1920s. And a lot of them went to Cuba to bathe in Bacardi rum, as the advertisement went. But the Bacardis were thinking that it would also make sense, given the thirst of Americans and their eagerness to find liquor, to open a distillery in Mexico, which would be easy for a lot of Americans from Western United States to get down to. So it was because of Prohibition that they decided to expand in Mexico. They also, in Mexico, of course, produces a lot of sugar as well, so it made sense for there to be a distillery in Mexico. The initial results were very disappointing. It turns out that Mexicans were not big rum drinkers, and not that many Americans went to Mexico to look for rum. And then shortly, only just a couple of years after the distillery opened, Prohibition ended in the United States, so that took away that source of business. But one of the Bacardi in-laws, a man by the name of Pepin Bosch, was sent to Mexico in the early 30s to close the business down. He decided that it was too early to close it down. He decided that with a more aggressive marketing campaign in Mexico, he could make it a thriving business. His emphasis was to accentuate the importance of drinking rum with Coke. Coca-Cola was a big beverage in Mexico, and so even though rum and Coke had already been introduced as a cocktail that could be made with Bacardi rum, Pepin Bausch decided that it had not yet been fully exploited in Mexico, and Bacardi Advertising in Mexico really emphasized its association with Coca-Cola, and then he was able to turn it around, and the company in the end was very successful in Mexico.
When did that drink start being called the Cuba Libre?
The Cuba Libre. Well, so American soldiers are occupying Cuba after the Independence War. From 1898 to 1902, thousands of American soldiers and their command sends down cases and cases and cases of Coca-Cola for the soldiers. And the barkeepers in Havana and Santiago put in stocks of Coca-Cola for all the American soldiers who are their customers. And legend has it that one bartender in Havana, while he's serving Coke to his soldiers at the bar, suggests that they try mixing it with a little bit of Bacardi rum and see what they think. And it allegedly was a huge hit, and the soldiers congratulated the bartender on his brilliant innovation, and the bartender suggests a toast, Viva Cuba Libre, long live a free Cuba, and the soldiers answer him, Cuba Libre, and as a result of that toast in that bar on that afternoon, the rum and Coke cocktail acquired this nickname of the Cuba Libre.
Tom Gelton is with us. His new book is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phones to Jean in Dallas. Hello, Jean.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much. And I first wanted to say that my book club, Mr. Gelton, just read your book for our discussion 2 weeks ago. So this I wish you'd been on the air before we had the discussion. But I've been chomping at the bit just to ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
You were just talking a while ago about the Cuban independence, and when my question is two-part. First, when you look at the fact that Cubans have been, up until the Castro administration, fiercely independent, fighting three wars all the way up to the Spanish-American War and starting with the 10 Years' War, and then going all the way, and as you mentioned, the Bacardi family has always been a part of that, either actively fighting or funding the cause. And when you pull it forward in your book into current day, they go so far as to fighting with the anti-Castro movement and working with Tom DeLay around Section 211. So obviously the Bacardis have been an integral part of independence. My question is twofold. The first part is, given that history of fierce independence from the Cubans' perspective, why has Castro been able to stay in power for 40-plus years? And then the second part of my question is, if the Castro regime does fall now that Raul is in power, what role would the Bacardi family play, particularly when you mention in your book so many of the family members either don't have a direct tie to Cuba anymore or are dispersed all over the world? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Jean, the whole idea of my book is that you can tell all of Cuban history through the Bacardi story, and you've asked me to sum up the entire 150 years of Cuban history in one answer, spanning all the way from the War of 1868 to Tom DeLay in 1980. To make a really long and fascinating story as short as I can make it, the Bacardis were indeed associated with all these patriotic and revolutionary causes. And then in 1960, much to their dismay, they were confiscated. Their assets were all confiscated, and they go into exile. And from their point of view, their idea of fighting for Cuba takes on a different manifestation. It instead of fighting for Cuba's independence from Spain or from the United States or fighting against Batista or Machado, the Cuban dictators, Cuban patriotism in the Bacardi view becomes associated with the fight against Castro. Castro is seen as having introduced communism on the island, and for the sake of the Cuban nation, they are opposing Castro. Now, one of the sort of the ironic things about that is that they, having been associated so long with the fight for an independent Cuba, they start working with and through the U.S. government. I mean, they participate in the Bay of Pigs invasion in the early 1960s. They are big supporters of, the U.S. trade embargo. And then, as you say, they get allied with Tom DeLay, in a very complicated legal struggle. This is part of the story. I mean, some people would say that this is kind of a sad development, that they are forced into exile and that their patriotism takes on this more negative association. But it's just part of the story, and it's why the Bacardis are such a perfect vehicle through which to tell the ups and downs of the Cuban struggle over all these years. Now, as far as your question about the future of Cuba, I just think it's way too soon to tell. That in some ways, the Castro regime has been able to stay in power so long in Cuba for the same reason that Spain was able to stay in power in Cuba for so long, which is simply that it's an island, and that it's very hard to mount a resistance movement on an island when the powers that be have most of the guns. It took years and years and years, decades, for Cuban independence fighters to gain their independence. And, Fidel Castro and his forces have been able to keep a lid on that country since they've been in power, in some ways similar to the way Spain was able to keep the country under control all the years that it controlled the island.
Well, let's catch people up a little bit who hadn't read the book as carefully or haven't seen it yet and hadn't read it as carefully as Gene. Let's talk about how the Bacardis went from having run afoul of the Batista administration, supporting sort of quietly but financially the young Fidel Castro.
Yeah. I mean, the Bacardis, had this kind of reputation in Cuba for being, left of center. I mean, very progressive politically, always associated with kind of progressive movements, and they hated Batista. They had their own run-ins with Batista as a company. Pepin Bosch, who was the chairman of Bacardi during those years, was actually in the government of President Carlos Prio in Cuba, who was overthrown by Batista. So they had a lot of reasons to oppose Batista. And when Fidel Castro's movement got organized, they were donating money left and right, thousands and thousands of dollars from their own pockets to buy weapons for Fidel. To Bacardi women were knitting socks for Fidel's fighters up in the mountains. They and Pepin Bosch, the chairman of the company, was on the record. He was willing to go on the record in interviews with foreign newspaper correspondents saying, Batista has to go, Fidel is our man. This took a lot of courage for him. When Fidel came into power, Pepin Bosch was known as the Cuban businessman who was most loyal to Fidel for a long time. And when Fidel made his first trip to Washington, his one and only trip to Washington as Cuba's leader, he picked one Cuban businessman to go with him, Pepin Bosch, because Pepin Bosch was the Cuban businessman most associated with the Cuban Revolution. So, yeah, there was a long period there where the Bacardis were very tight with Fidel Castro and with the Cuban Revolution.
Is it possible to go so far as to say that the Bacardis, who later on would so vehemently oppose the Castro administration, did they make it possible for Fidel Castro to take power?
That would probably be a little bit of a reach, but I think it would not be an exaggeration to say that Fidel Castro could not have taken power without the broad support of the Cuban middle and upper class. Not as much the upper class, but certainly the Cuban bourgeoisie or the Cuban middle class as a whole. He could not have taken power just on the basis of what he and his rebel fighters up in the mountains were doing. It really, they had the support of a broad segment of the Cuban population at that time, of whom the Bacardis were perhaps the best examples in terms of their social class. But the Bacardis were not alone, and it's no question that Fidel needed that very broad support in order to consolidate his revolution and overthrow Batista.
What did the Bacardis believe about what would happen to their company before it was, in fact, nationalized or an attempt was made to nationalize it by Fidel Castro?
Well, I think they had in mind that Cuba was going to move to kind of a social welfare state. I mean, there are other examples, Venezuela to some extent, Costa Rica. In Europe, you have countries like Sweden, where on the one hand, there is a real commitment to social change and social justice and the redistribution of wealth, but that stops short of being socialism. And I think the Bacardis had in mind that Cuba could become a model country in this regard, sort of in the mold of Sweden and some of these other countries, and that there was no reason to think that Cuba could not move forward without stopping short of socialism. I mean, there was a kind of a third way, and that's where the Bacardis expected and hoped Cuba was headed.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is NPR correspondent Tom Gelton, whose book is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Let's go next to Wichita Falls and speak with Natalie. Hi, Natalie.
Hello. I had a couple of questions for the guest, please. I wanted to know what you knew about the Bacardi name. Do you think the family has Italian or Sicilian roots? I'm just wondering there. And then getting to the rum and Coca-Cola drink that was popular in Mexico, the Cuba Libre, did this become popular before the original Coke formula was changed? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, at one time, there was even a little touch of cocaine added to that formula. And I wondered what you knew about that.
I'll take
the answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, first of all, the Bacardis came originally from the Catalonia region of Spain, which is up around Barcelona. And for your listeners who are familiar at all with Spain's geography, cultural geography, they'd know that Catalonia region is very distinct. They have their own language there, the Catalan language, and Catalan names are different than standard Spanish names, Castilian Spanish names. So Bacardi is a Catalan name from that part of Spain.
And they would have pronounced it Bacardi,
Bacardi, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's become sort of anglicized now. Both the Bacardis themselves and, you know, with all the publicity that we've seen, it's now been sort of changed to be Bacardi. But, yeah, originally it was Bacardi, and Spanish speakers would still say Bacardi. As far as the Coca-Cola is concerned, you know, this is a book about Bacardi and rum in Cuba, and you know, there have been books written about the history of Coca-Cola, and I think the listeners should have to go to those sources. I don't know. I've heard this before, that there was at some point there was some coca mixed in there, but you know, which an element of cocaine, but I really have no idea if that's true, when it was true, and you know, whether that was at the same time that the Cuba Libre was introduced or not.
Tom Gelton is my guest. He's an NPR correspondent whose new book is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. You can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is NPR correspondent Tom Gelton, whose book, just released in paperback, is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One thing that turned out to be incredibly serendipitous for the Bacardis was that they had put a distillery in Puerto Rico in 1937.
Yeah. And the reason for that was that Puerto Rico was a U.S. colony, and therefore rum produced in Puerto Rico could enter the United States tariff-free. At that time, there was a fairly significant tariff on imported rum from other countries, but rum that came in from Puerto Rico was able to be sold in the United States for a couple dollars a bottle cheaper than rum that came in from a foreign country. And so the Bacardis, in their eagerness to really exploit the U.S. market, decided to establish a distillery in Puerto Rico. It took a long time for them to get permission from the Puerto Rican authorities to do that. But you're right, that then, of course, by the 1950s, and then in the 1940s, Bacardi almost was taken over by the Batista regime. And in the 1950s, the Bacardis were very worried. Because of their outspoken opposition to Batista, they were very worried that Batista was going to confiscate the company. And so this Puerto Rican operation was really kind of a safety outlet for them. It was a way for them to really do a lot of production outside Cuba. And interestingly enough, Chris, in 1957, they were so worried about Batista taking over their company that they moved their trademark registration outside of Cuba to protect it, to get it out of the reach of Batista. And as it turned out, of course, in 1960, it was not Batista but Fidel Castro who took over their company. But having prepared for a takeover from Batista, they were, in fact, prepared for Fidel to take it over, even though they had not considered that was a danger.
It must have been a wrenching decision for Pepin Bosch to sort of pack up his family and get out of this country, where the company had already had a very long history, and obviously the families were well settled there. But they tried very hard to bring as many of their employees along as they could.
You know, the remarkable thing about Bacardi as a company today is that even though it's this huge multinational, it is still owned entirely by a single family, the Bacardi family. And this is almost unprecedented in business annals for a family company to remain family-owned, family-controlled, down through six or even seven generations. I don't know of any other example in the world of a company this large and this international that has remained a family company. And one of the reasons for that, Chris, is that when they were expelled from Cuba, they weren't really expelled, but when they went into exile, when their properties were all confiscated in Cuba and they went into exile, that experience sort of brought them back together again. And you're right, Pepin Bosch, and, you know, a lot of Cubans who left Cuba at that time, you know, had basically the shirt on their backs and nothing else. Pepin Bosch found housing for family members who were leaving Cuba. He got jobs for family members in the company. They had to be willing to sort of move elsewhere, maybe to Puerto Rico, maybe to Brazil, maybe to Bahamas, maybe elsewhere in the United States. But he was able to get jobs for them. And what this experience did, is it reinforced that bond between the family and the company. It sort of brought the family back together around the company and made them more loyal to the company. And it kind of started the clock ticking again, you know, so that Pepin Bosch, you know, this really reinforced the family character of the company and kept it together.
Did they imagine that the Castro regime could possibly last as long as it has?
No, they didn't, and I think they probably have that in common with many Cubans who went into exile and figured it was just going to be a few months or at the most a few years before they could go back and pick up where they left off. You know, I think that they did not. There has been a fair amount of wishful thinking on the part of a lot of Cuban exiles over the years, and the Bacardis, even though they, you know, were genuine Cuban patriots and in touch with the sort of the soul of the country, I think that when they lost everything in Cuba and became so embittered as a result of that and so angry at Fidel and they felt betrayed and double-crossed, I think they didn't realize that their experience was unique, that, you know, they had a very wealthy business in Cuba, which they lost, you know, but there were many, many Cubans who did not lose anything as a result of the revolution, who did not have businesses confiscated. And, you know, at that point, there was kind of a gap. A gap was kind of opened between the outlook of the exiles and the outlook of many Cubans who stayed on the island.
Can you talk a little bit about what Pepin Bosch was involved in terms of trying from a distance to fight the Castro regime?
Yeah. Pepin Bosch is a remarkable guy. Along with Emilio Bacardi, these are the two main characters in my book, and they're both really fascinating, colorful characters who bring Cuban history to life. Pepin Bosch married Don Facundo's granddaughter, so he was an in-law. He was part of the family by marriage. In the 1930s, he, as a young Cuban man, became involved in a revolution then against the dictator Gerardo Machado, and he was out buying weapons for this movement to overthrow the Machado regime. In the 1950s, Pepin Bosch was buying weapons for Fidel Castro, and in the 1960s, he was buying weapons for the movement to overthrow Castro. So, you know, a lot of people have paid a lot of attention to what Pepin Bosch did in the 1960s to overthrow Fidel Castro. But one of the points I make is that this is totally in keeping with his history, his pattern. I mean, he'd always been a believer in revolutions. I think Cuban political culture in general has been always quick to resort to violence in pursuit of political change. That was true in the 50s, and it was true in the 60s, just in a different form. But Pepin Bosch, I think, personally felt really betrayed by Fidel Castro. And, you know, having spent 30-some thousand dollars of his own money to buy weapons for Fidel, in the 50s, turned around in the 1960s and spent another fortune of his own money trying to overthrow Fidel.
I know, Tom, that this book was years in the making, and I'm wondering if part of the reason it took so long, aside from the fact that you have a very demanding full-time job, is that you are trying to research a private company, not a public company, a private family, and then you're dealing on the other side with records of the Cuban government.
You know, Chris, I don't think I could have picked two entities that are more difficult to work with. You're right. I mean, the Bacardis have had a kind of a default position for many years of just not talking to the press. They have this in common with many private companies. As a private company, they don't have to disclose their, you know, business operations or assets to anyone. And they have kept a lot of things to themselves. A lot of negative things have been written about the Bacardis over the years, in part because of their involvement in various kind of conspiratorial activities against Fidel Castro. And in response, they just decided, we don't care what you write about us, we're just not going to talk. So it took a lot of time to convince individual family members that I wanted to tell, that I was fascinated by their history, and that it was a story worth telling, and that I would tell it fairly. And in time, they did agree to open up. And as you say, the Cuban government was also very difficult. The Cubans are, you know, extremely wary about U.S. reporters in general, about U.S. news reporters, and even more so about U.S. journalists who are writing books. They keep a lot of their records private, closed as well. What I needed to do in Cuba was I worked through a lot of Cuban friends and historians and associates, people who did have access to archival materials in Cuba. But even so, it took me a long, long time to kind of do all the research that was needed to reconstruct this story that covers 150 years.
As a journalist, does it already feel distinctly different to work in Cuba now that it's not Fidel, but in fact his brother Raul, who is running the country?
Well, a little different. I was there, actually, the last time I was there, I haven't been there since my book came out, the last time I was there was in May of 2008, and a few months earlier, Raul had given, as the new president of Cuba, with Fidel sort of still in the hospital, Raul had given this speech where he encouraged Cubans to complain, literally. He encouraged Cubans to make known their criticisms of every aspect of life and the government, anything that that they didn't like, that they thought needed to be changed. And he and his supporters or his associates in the government actually sort of gave one newspaper in particular, the Juventud Rebelde, which is the used to be the official newspaper of the communist youth in Cuba. He gave them the assignment of going out and critiquing Cuban society and Cuban economic activity. And teams of reporters from Juventud Rebelde did stories, investigative stories about the shortcomings of Cuban agriculture and Cuban education and Cuban health care, stories that no foreign reporter would ever have been able to do, because these reporters who were working with the implicit support of the authorities in Cuba. And so you saw kind of a flowering there of Cuban journalism that I had never seen in all the years that I had been covering Cuba. And it was a very exciting time to be in Cuba. This is May of 2008. Now, unfortunately, I think for whatever reason, a few months later, the authorities, whether it was Raul or whether it was Fidel himself, who was gradually getting better, apparently they decided that this had gone on a little too far, and they put the brakes on. And so you haven't seen that kind of self-criticism over the last year in Cuba. It's really sort of, unfortunately, kind of slid back to the way it was before, a very highly controlled news media. I did feel that things were changing earlier. I honestly don't see evidence now that things have continued to change.
Do you think, Tom, there is sufficient, I guess the phrase is psychic damage, to the people who have been living under the Castro regime all this time, that even if something were to sort of radically open up, that rebuilding Cuba would be far more complicated than even people who hope to see this happen might imagine?
That's exactly right, Chris. I couldn't agree with you more. One of the paradoxes of Cuba today is even though it's a socialist country that's been under socialism now for for 50 years, and you know, one of the features of socialism supposedly is unity, and to, you know, everybody sort of in this together. But life has been hard in Cuba, and paradoxically, it seems that Cubans have sort of become more individualistic, which you wouldn't expect to happen under socialism. But they tend to sort of to each his own, and kind of you know, are very wary of each other. And you know, the society has kind of become atomized in a way that you know, a lot of Cubans just don't trust their own neighbors. And I think this has really made it much more difficult to get the kind of collective movement that you need to rebuild a country. I contrast Cuba, for example, with Poland. You know, in Poland, you had the Catholic Church in Poland stayed a very vibrant institution throughout the years of communism and provided a kind of a national focus, a national unity for the Polish people that was separate from the communist state. And as a result, the church was able to play a leadership role when it came time to kind of rebuild Polish society. There's no institution like that in Cuba. There's no institution where the national identity has been preserved in a way that is separate from the government, from the state. The state has sort of so overwhelmed everything that without the state, you know, what you've got is just a collection of individuals who are fearful and skeptical and suspicious and cynical and alienated. And I think that's going to make it much more difficult to build a truly national movement of reconciliation and reconstruction in Cuba.
So the Facundo Bacardi, who runs the company today, is a direct descendant of the original founder. But this is a guy who was born and raised in Chicago. Does he really have a deep connection to his Cuban heritage in the way that maybe his forebears within the company might have hoped?
Well, no. No, it would be impossible for him. And it's not just Facundo. It's this whole new generation. Let's say the seventh generation of Bacardis, almost all of them, were born outside Cuba. You know, the passage of time is a really important factor. And it's not only that. It's also, if you look at the company itself, I mean, this is a company that now owns the Grey Goose vodka brand, Dewar's Whiskey, you know, all these other spirits brands. It's a multinational company. It's really expanded dramatically beyond Cuba, beyond rum. You know, we are no longer talking about a small family rum company, you know, with a close tie to Cuba the way we were in the 1950s or 1960s. There's now this enormous multinational company, and young Bacardis are concerned about the value of their stock holdings.
Like anybody else. Yeah. Tom Gelton, I'm so sorry we're out of time. The new book is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. It has been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.